Hare Krishna. So, continuing with Canto 4, Chapter 9, Dhruva Maharaj returns home. So last week we got up to just the first half a dozen verses. So, one of the essay questions which you need to write an essay on at some stage is the personal application and drawing relevant points for application from Dhruva Maharaj's prayers, verses 14 to 17 in this ninth chapter. That's not an essay topic actually, but it's a it's a topic we want to discuss. It's a personal application topic, but it's not one of your essays. In this chapter, the essay question is actually a preaching application question. How is the example of Dhruva Maharaj returning back to Godhead in spite of his performing devotional service with material motives relevant for preaching? Especially verses 9 to 10, 29 to 31, and 32 to 35. Relate to that point of his performing devotional service with material motives. How is that relevant for our preaching? That, you know, in spite of having those material motives, he was able to go back to Godhead. You know, in what way would that affect the way we preach to people? We'll have a look at that today. And of course, in your essays, you'll want to give additional references from Bhagavatam, Cantos 1 to 6, and other Bhakti Shastras in general. Somewhere at the end of the class, we'll see if we can get a soft copy of those chapter summaries. And also, if anyone doesn't have a soft copy of the student handbook, then they can get a soft copy of that as well. What I do is, at the end of class, probably the easiest thing for me to do is to give you a soft copy of the student handbook that I've sort of edited a little bit, and I'm pretty sure that's got everything you need, so you can just refer to that one, and then there may be some students who don't have a copy at all, they can have a copy. So, and then, you know, then you'll have, everyone will have everything plus the essay questions that you need to refer to, and the homework questions and slogans and everything included. So, we discussed how Dhruva Maharaj, although he was a small boy, he wanted to offer prayers to the Supreme Lord. The Lord the Lord understood his awkward position, and he touched him with his conch shell to the forehead of Dhruva Maharaj. In this way, you know, gave him the ability to glorify him. And, you know, we discussed, as it describes in the purports, verse number 5 as well, that at that time Dhruva Maharaj became perfectly aware of the Vedic conclusion, understood the absolute truth. And his relationship, understood the absolute truth in his relationship with all living entities. The Dhruva Maharaj began to offer his prayers. So we discussed how, you know, one cannot simply understand academic learning, understand the Vedas by academic learning. You know, one has to have unflinching faith in the Lord and the spiritual master. We described here in the purport, Srila Prabhupada describes that he patiently executed the order of the spiritual master, and therefore he became so successful that he saw the Lord face to face. Now he was further enabled by the causeless mercy of the Lord to offer fitting prayers to the Lord. To glorify or offer prayers unto the Supreme, one needs the Lord's mercy. One cannot write to glorify the Lord unless one is endowed with his causeless mercy. So we discussed that, those points. It's very important because, you know, generally, if you... Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Hello. Hello. And the kids just got their mother's phone. Most gurus or people who start a spiritual or, you know, so-called gurus or so-called religious leaders, what people look for, you know, they don't look for someone who's faithfully executed the order of the spiritual master, you know, and has unflinching faith in the Supreme Lord. What they look for is that the person has, you know, had some miracle. You know, that, you know, in the case of Ramakrishna, you know, there was some big storm or something, and, you know, was it Goddess Kali appeared to him or something like that, and, you know, then he became, you know, so big miracle. You know, so that's the way people choose. That's the way, and then whatever he teaches, they'll accept. Oh, this is the conclusion. You know, so you know these points seem very simple and obvious to us, they should seem very simple and obvious to us, but you have to understand that these simple points completely annihilate, reveal all the imposters of this world. You know, so they're because these things you not find in their line. You know, all the gurus and so-called gurus and so-called leaders of religions. You know, usually there's some miracle, and then whatever they say is accepted. The fact that they haven't executed, the order of the spiritual master coming in the line of disciplic succession means nothing to anyone, But that is the essential point. That is the only real point. And the fact that someone has faith, in the Supreme Personality of God, it means nothing to anyone. You can worship Kali, you can worship this demigod, you can worship, dog, whatever. See? So we discuss that to some degree at length because it's extremely important. People even quote these stories of Dhruva Maharaj and say, oh, he was, he had some miracle, he was touched by the Lord with a conch shell. So they just refer to the miracle part of it. But, they just leave aside the real foundation of where he got that mercy. So, he actually got the mercy by faithfully and with great determination executing the order of Narada Muni. Then the Lord revealed himself to him and further enabled him. Dhruva Maharaj had, from the very beginning, Dhruva Maharaj did have faith that he was worshipping the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Personality of God, the Lord in the heart, at that. So these things enabled him to, achieve the goals he achieved. Srila Prabhupada mentions, of course, that, he mentions in the Bhagavad Gita that if one accepts, the personality of Godhead from the very beginning of one's study of the Bhagavad Gita, basically that person is liberated from the very beginning of their studies. It is such a so from the very beginning of his quest. Dhruva Maharaj did have faith that, in the personality of God, that he is a person, he exists as a, as a person. We see that that's not there, even in Christianity, you see that many people ask that, in the Bible it says in the beginning there was a word and the word is God. And people say, what does that mean? And Prabhupada's answer is that, if there's a word, it means that someone is speaking. If there's someone speaking, then God is a person. for many of them, whether God exists or not, they don't know. Like that, the word, what does that mean? There's some sound or, So, these points are, sometimes the truth is elusive because it's so simple. Isn't it? It's so simple, and this is again sometimes the difficulties some students have in reading Prabhupada's books is that it's presented so simply they keep waiting for some big thing, but they don't realise how powerful these simple points are, that they just really reveal the absolute truth. One who's fully acquainted with these truths, by the end of their reading of the Srimad Bhagavatam, will become, sufficiently God-realized and self-realized in order to go back to Godhead. So this is the sort of mood that we're imbibing here as we go through.
These simple points, all those simple, the other ones that completely annihilate the impostors.
They annihilate all the Maya's illusions and tricks and agents. And,
so you can use them to defeat all the
opponents. Yeah. One of my patients recently came with a guru called Patrick from Goa.
Right.
She said to me, "No, he's a real guru. Like he heals people. He just touched them and they get up in their wheelchair." And like I didn't have these points that my hand to master, and where did he get the healing? I didn't have the right thing there to bring out. Now I can keep coming back.
That's good.
She thinks I have the answer.
Yeah.
But now I can say no, Patrick.
Yeah.
But if you go on his website, like he's an art people all over the world, flying around, paying his airfares and accommodation. As a child, he had a coma, and he came out as a coma. And that's the miracle.
See,
that's the miracle. And now he's a guru.
And
he's
called
Patrick from Goa.
That's right, yeah.
I think he's from Goa itself, is enough to send against the progress. Because Goa is...
against the government.
It was fishing and non-sports.
Yeah, you can mention that point that, you know, it's interesting how people follow someone because they're really attracted to miracles, you know. And people can teach anything, you know, once they've presented that they've had some miracle, they can really teach anything, you know. But, you know, a real spiritual master, you know, they don't self-advertise themselves. They just really want to pass on the teachings that are coming down in disciplic succession. So they're not there to, you know, advertise themselves as someone who's, you know, some great person who's, you know, achieved miracles and, you know, like that. They're really just passing on the message, and in order to pass on the message which has come down in disciplic succession through the ancient scriptures, you know, they just live a very pure lifetime and lifestyle, and you know, they practice what that message themselves, and you know, that's really the qualities of a proper spiritual master. You know, as soon as people start you know, self-advertising their miracles and what have you, then you know, it's how you attract cheap followers, really. You know? And then, you know, then we have to question that, you know, what are their miracles in comparison to Krishna? That, you know, they, you know, people become so absorbed in some tiny little so-called miracle that they actually forget the qualities of the supreme controller of, you know, everything, you know, which is the real thing that they should be absorbed in. And that Yogeshvara or Krishna, you know, the master of all mystic perfections, you know, what are his teachings? We don't want to hear the teachings of someone who's performed some insignificant miracle. We want to hear the teachings of the person who's performed, you know, unlimited miracles. Who, you know, the person who makes the sun rise, what has he got to say? Yeah, that's the thing.
So, sorry, it's a different topic. So what's the destination of such, I mean, both the bogus gurus and their followers.
They all go to hell.
I mean, they all, you know, it's like, actually, what about Sai Baba and Sai Baba, the likes and their followers?
Prabhupada gives this example. Someone was going to offer you, say, $10 million. And then someone comes along and interferes with that, so you don't get that $10 million.
Sorry, that was a good offer?
No, say someone is going to offer you $10 million. And then someone comes along and interferes in such a way that you don't get that. That opportunity is lost. What happens? They interfere in such a way that opportunity is lost. How much harm that person has caused you. So if people don't get Krishna's gift to go back to Godhead and not take birth in the animal species or what have you, how much harm has that person done? And to how many? This is the position of these bogus gurus. They go with him.
What about, like, I was reading about Ananda Mayima. For instance, like, she was apparently a Vaishnavi, but like, she was...
What's her name?
Ananda Mayima.
Yeah. Is she the hugging...
No, that's another.
Oh, that's another.
Yeah. Probably Ananda Mayima, like, she was born and, like, she was just always chanting the Lord's name, and then she got married, but it was never consummated.
Always preaching, she got heaps of followers, and she just, like, was a Vaishnavi, she went to like and stuff, but wasn't directly giving Krishna some people couldn't, like, I don't know, thinking, yeah, what about people like that, or...
No,
well, you know, there, if someone is an actual devotee, then, they may not be completely properly situated. In other words, they may have some Vaishnava qualities, and they may also, you know, enjoy some, you know, fame and reputation. You know, because sometimes that is there. So, you know, here we're reading about Dhruva Maharaj, who, you know, was a devotee but had material desires. So, you know, it is... So, I mean, if they have some sincere devotee qualifications, but at the same time they may have some... you know, by and large they're sincere, but they may have some other motives, then, you know, there's still... benefit for them. Of course, we don't necessarily follow their teachings, but we don't, if they're in that category, then we don't disrespect them. We particularly follow the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because he says, Nadanam Najanam Nasundarim Kabitam Vajigirisha Kamayam Mama Janmani Janmani Sri Bhavatad Bhakya Haitiki Twayim. He says, oh my Lord, I have no desire to accumulate wealth. So even though he wants to be a devotee of the Lord, he doesn't want to gain wealth by that devotion. I don't want any followers. See, you know, they don't self-advertise themselves, you know. You know, not even after liberation. So sometimes people are offering, will give you liberation. Lord Chaitanya is saying, I'm not after liberation. Not after anything, you know. What do you want? Just let me serve the Lord life after life, like that. So we accept teachings from in that line. But if someone is a devotee, but still they may desire so many different things, we, you know, offer them respect if they're a devotee. But we have to be Jai. But, you know, you have to look very carefully whether they even are a sincere devotee with some material motivation, because some of them, many people who call themselves a Vaishnava or a Vaishnavi, they're actually impersonalists. And they see that, you know, God is, because God is everything, then you can worship anything and anyone and do anything, you know, and everything, and that's still pleasing to Krishna. So some people worship Krishna and still think, teach something bogus, that you can serve Krishna in any way because God is everything. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives, you know, he says, you know, that, you know, if you actually want to be a devotee properly, then you should think of me, Krishna. You know, not Kali, Durga, Shiva, and chant, what's that? Yeah, no mix, and just, you know, chanting my glories, my names, you know, talking about Krishna, not Kali's glories and this. So when we see that some of them are actually say they're a devotee of Krishna, but actually worship everyone and what have you, then they're Vaishnavas who are not actually Vaishnavas. They call themselves Vaishnavas, let's put it that way. They call themselves Vaishnavas because they also worship Krishna or Vishnu. But actually, because they do it in an impersonal way, they're not real Vaishnavas, they're actually impersonalists or Mayavadis. You know, so we have to also make that. Then, of course, we just avoid their teachings altogether. And, you know, and they're sort of... even though they can be very pleasing, they're you know, they're very dangerous. It is, yes. But, you know, that's why we study these, you know, teachings of the Srimad Bhagavatam, because then you are able to, you know, if you come across different people, you will be able to distinguish, you know, exactly where they fit in and where they don't, yeah. Otherwise, it gets very tricky.
I've heard, like, you know, especially in the yoga, asana, ashtanga world, like, do good and...
What is that? God's...
Do good and try and see beauty everywhere and God's everything, you know?
That's right, yeah, that's the impression, yeah. So, therefore... You know, some spiritual teachers even. So the most beautiful thing in creation is the form of a woman. You know, that God is in everything, and they just see God's beautiful creation.
Yeah.
That really, they're just, you know, in the name of God consciousness, they're just looking at the opposite sex, you know. But now they've got not only do they want sex life, but they want to be respected as a highly religious, spiritually elevated person for their sex life, you know. So. Yes. So, you know,
it just shows it doesn't purify our hearts.
No, that's right. It doesn't purify the heart. In fact, what happens is Prabhupada, we read this, I think, in the first canto, that, you know, was it the first canto? Was it, you know, impersonalist philosophy tends to make people's attraction to sex life stronger, because they feel that, you know, for those who actually are attracted to the spiritual world, they see that, you know, what we enjoy in this world is sort of something quite insignificant. But if people think, well, there, you know, in the spiritual world, there's no variety, no, you know, enjoyment of the senses like that, then they think that what we have here is that's your only opportunity to enjoy like this, because if you attain liberation, you're basically going to float around wishing you're back in the material world. That's right, yeah. So actually, for impersonalists, sometimes they become, more attracted to sense gratification as a result of that dry philosophy. So it's very dangerous for them and for their followers. That's right. Yeah. What's that? No. Yeah. Yeah. And new answer?
Yeah, I was asking, we got the four disciples, succession at four sampradayas. Mm. If you look at the Vedic culture, those Vedic and our Gaudiya sampradaya. So, in other religions like Christianity and all that, we discuss some of the gurus, but then really the real guru will be from these four disciples' successions.
No. There's Jesus Christ is a guru. Muhammad is a guru. And there are gurus. What's that?
The twelve disciples.
They were taught, so then they become gurus. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There are, and then, the followers, those who follow, as you say, Jesus or Muhammad, they're also gurus.
But they are not really teaching about Krishna.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
They're basically, if you look at their, the disciplical succession, those people, the interpretation, I'm not trying to offend anyone, I'm just trying to discuss over here. It's basically as Prabhupada used to say, where is the true Christianity? Because thou shalt not kill. And in every lecture, in America initially, he said, you're not following even the Christianity. Mm-hmm. The very first word, thou shalt not kill.
No, but those who do. Yeah.
So, if it's not coming down from Jesus to disciple succession, so those disciples, from Jesus, they are not actually telling the truth and not taking you back to Godhead. So that's where my question is
coming. They take you back to God, but they don't take you back to a personal God. They take you back to all the teachings are the same, because they're basically philosophically very, very much the same. The difference is, you get to know God personally this way, but otherwise, very much similar.
No, I understand that. My question is, Prabhu, coming from the gurus, where I'm looking at the Vedic, coming from the Indian background, so I could be a little bit biased over here. In India, we got this, or in the Vedic literature, we got this four Vedic sampradayas. And we follow, any guru's succession. When we read the Vedic literature, we always think, four sampradayas. Are we, you belong to Sri Sampradaya, you belong to Gaudiya Sampradaya, and you have accepted the guru from there. And we follow on that disciple succession. So my question is, when Prabhupada is talking about this disciple succession, in the broader sense, is that what he meant?
If someone is following the teachings of Jesus or Muhammad, then they're in the disciplic succession properly, and then a person can make progress in the spiritual life in the same way that we can. So the fact is that many of there are a huge proportion of followers of Jesus and Muhammad, who don't follow the teachings, and therefore they're sort of disconnected from the disciplic succession. But if they actually follow, then you can say that they're connected properly, in that line from Jesus. You know, the it's a very broken line, you know, and therefore it's becoming a little bit hopeless because the teachings are so distorted and what have you. But you know, it's possible, but it's not really happening. So you know, in that sense, we don't say that so for instance, if people took advice from this Krishna consciousness movement and we discussed with someone who is a Christian, we can actually help them to follow Jesus properly, and then they would be properly connected to Jesus in that disciple succession. So if they follow Prabhupada's teachings about how to properly serve Jesus, they would then be properly situated. We can also help the Muslims to be proper Muslims. All of them. When Prabhupada travelled around the world, you know, when he was in, you know, Tehran or, you know, this country, that country, where there were a predominance of particular religions, they would bring him the scholars and what have you, and he would say, well, that's not Muhammad's teachings, or who authorised you to change this, or like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it is possible, if they follow Srila Prabhupada's, take shelter of Srila Prabhupada, for them to be a proper Christian or a proper Muslim, and then to be properly situated in that line, properly connected, and to make then substantial through to progress. So that is possible. So we can't say that they don't, you know, you can't make progress at all as a Christian or as a Muslim or this
no,
or that. It is possible.
It's not like, you know, being Muslim or Christian.
Yeah.
I'm saying that
we recognize
that the disciple succession in India is sort of formulated like, for example, Mohammedans, like, you know, Muslims. Their line is like, you know, basically their own interpretations they have formulated so much. You listen to, I mean, I've watched some of the documentaries and I said, no, that's not the preaching, you know, coming from, you know, the prophet from Muhammad. So, like, you know, if he convoluted, so much convoluted, if you're going to follow that, how are they going to realize the back to Godhead?
But these distortions have taken place like everywhere, even in the so-called Hinduism, when they have these red ceremonies, and they call themselves Brahmanas, and they go out and eat lobster and wine.
Prabhu, this is my question. I think what you're saying, but then people like Muslims and all, they're eating meat. They normally they say that when there's no mercy, you cannot have any good quality. So, if they're doing all the religious activities,
they need to be corrected.
And eating meat, and they say that Quran is saying that. So, then how do we understand that?
Yeah, well, therefore, as I said, that this Krishna consciousness movement guides them to have the proper understanding of their own religious scriptures, so that some that they can eat meat. You know, some religions, because they're you know, people are determined to eat meat. Some religions are for the meat, the class of meat eaters. But Lord Chaitanya, he instructed the Chankazi. But when it comes to the cow, you know, how can you justify that from your scriptures? Because the cow's in a special category, is like eating your mother, because you're actually raised from the cow's milk. You see, so therefore, Lord Chaitanya actually rejected the idea that cow killing is accepted, you know, within the Muslim scripture.
So that means, so long as Prabhupada says sheep and goat is okay.
Yeah.
So then if they eat just that, then they eat chicken also.
Under
Prabhupada says sheep and goat.
That's right. And under certain restrictions, then yes, they can still follow. Then they have There are some things they're allowed to do under restriction, and then they offer prayers, which is purifying, Prabhupada said, you know, this feature where the Muslims will stop, you know, at a certain time of the day, whatever's happening, and just bow down to God. He said, this is a very good quality, you know, this is just... So, you know, there are some aspects of their religion, you know, well, if they actually follow it all properly, they will make progress. But they do need some guidance as to, you know, there are some restrictions. Generally, most restrictions are just being absolutely, neglected. So, you know, thou shalt not kill for the Christians, you know, and for the Muslims, you know, there are many, many things that they should not be doing, which they're completely neglecting. So they need some advice. And the only ones who are able to really properly give them that advice is this Krishna consciousness movement.
The Quran is
them, yes, that they can. The Krishna consciousness movement can help them to follow their Quran.
No, what I'm saying, if the person is interested in following their Quran,
yes,
they are totally that way dedicated.
Yes.
Well, actually, I have a friend. He is a Muslim.
Yes.
And he is very religious from his aspect.
Mm.
But basically, I don't get into discussions with him because they eat meat. But he does all that prayer and everything he does. Once I had a discussion with him, and he was telling me that if people are not eating meat, then there will be no vegetables.
Well, it's debatable what they are following, you know.
So you mean that this Christianity was altered by the Prince Henry or something?
For instance, like when Prabhupada was in Tehran, he was speaking to one, you know, scholar and you know, on the you know, Muslim religion, and he was saying that there they, you know, they reduced the prayers that are chanted five times a day to three times a day. And Prabhupada said, on whose authority was that reduced? And, you know, and, you know, it put the philosopher immediately, you know, it was revealed that, you know, many such things, without, you know, the authority of Muhammad or you know, a, you know, they're actually doing all sorts of things. And the philosopher was saying that he was saying that there was something like, I don't know, so many hundred different varieties of the Muslim religion. So this one is adjusted. This you know, the same as Christianity. You know, like you can't find, you know, a what you say standard of Christianity. You know. Not only the many different churches and I understand, but within the one church, everyone's got their own, you know, interpretation of the Bible, the Quran, or what have you, like that. So,
the Quran,
yeah, definitely. So, you know, without authority, they say they're following, but then you've got to say, well, which one of the 200 or 300 versions of following the Quran are you following? That's your answer to that. If they say, yes, I strictly follow the Quran, you say, yeah, which of the 200 or 300 versions of the Quran are you following? And do you adjust that yourself? So, you know, then, you know, they can understand, you know, that, oh, you know, yes, many adjustments. So I'm following something which is adjusted. Am I actually following the Quran? So then it becomes debatable, you know, that are they following the Quran or something that someone's adjusted without authorization?
Somebody, suppose somebody asked changed.
Yeah.
You are supposed to ask him or not. Prabhupada said you ask him or not.
Shall therefore you...
Prabhupada is an acharya. Yeah. And we accept it.
Yeah.
But other person can also question it. Then what do we have?
Everyone in ISKCON follows that. Everyone. There's no one in ISKCON who you know, has a different number. You know, they may chant more or less, but everyone knows that 16 rounds is the minimum. Everyone in ISKCON. No one doesn't accept that. Yes. Because that's what Sureshwara was explaining, that you know, he was representing the GBC's position on Srila Prabhupada. It's actually when Srila Prabhupada, what happened was the Gaudiya mission actually failed. So to say that the Gaudiya mission chanted 64 rounds, actually the Gaudiya mission dismantled. You know, at the time of Srila Prabhupada, there was no real Gaudiya mission. When Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati left the planet, it just completely broke up. So, therefore, in fact, Srila Prabhupada had to start a new branch, you know, in the line of Gaudiyas. And when Srila Prabhupada, you know, started the International Society of Krishna Consciousness, he tried to get help from his god brothers, and no one would help. Therefore, he had to do it by himself. And you know, for many different reasons, you see that Srila Prabhupada was placed in the position, you know, by Krishna, whereas he literally had to become the founder acharya of a branch of Lord Chaitanya's movement. Otherwise, Lord Chaitanya's movement would actually, you know, just have dissipated at that time. See, so Srila Prabhupada was given full authorization by his guru. He was the only person available to, you know, not only spread but to keep Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission alive properly. he was also, it wasn't by his own self-advertisement, but his disciples, you know, understood that he was, you know, naturally the Prabhupada was, directly and indirectly, he was fully conscious of every aspect of, you know, the ISKCON movement or the International Society of Krishna Consciousness. Therefore, on that grounds also, you know, he was the natural selection for founder of Charya. So, Srila Prabhupada was, his position is, you know, we can't by the arrangement of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Srila Prabhupada was the founder of Charya who had to set the standards for what was practical for the first time that the Krishna consciousness movement had actually ever properly spread throughout the whole world. Right? So therefore, he was the only person authorized and available, and he set the standard of 16 rounds. So it's a very unique situation in history that we can't just say, you can't just take that whole history away and it's just like, oh, one day Prabhupada was walking down the street with his god brothers and he said, well, you all chant 64 and I'm going to start a movement and make it 16. It wasn't a haphazard thing like that. You know, it was a transcendental arrangement by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu where an empowered preacher who was empowered, you know, Saktivesh avatar, was empowered to spread Krishna consciousness throughout the whole world, who was given direct authorization by his spiritual master, and at a time when his movement had completely collapsed. Now, he had full right to adjust. No one else was in that position. And no one else will ever have that position. In this day of Brahma, that is the only time it will happen. And it's a very rare event. You know, it doesn't happen. So it's not just a whimsical thing. You know, it's a very rare occasion that Prabhupada made an adjustment where he was the only person in the position and had full authority to do it. No, well, he adjusted it.
He was put in a situation, or Krishna put him in a situation where he had to stand on his own feet literally without any other help. This is Guru Maharaj's thing, and he had to carry out Guru Maharaj's instruction. And so he had to make adjustment and change the circumstances.
Yeah. And he was authorized and empowered to do that. So therefore, anyone else says, I think Prabhupada says it should be 16, I think it should be 18. But what is that person's position? You know, compare the histories. It doesn't add up. That's just a whimsical someone competing out of envy with Prabhupada, you know. And it, actually Prabhupada understood very quickly that for Krishna consciousness to actually be spread throughout the world, it was not possible for them to chant 64 rounds as they had done in India, you know, when Vedic culture was still somewhat prevalent. It was not possible, you know, to get as Kali Yuga progresses, even 16 rounds, you know, we know, you know, is difficult, you know. So I don't think anyone would question, you know, that Prabhupada should have left at 64. I chant 64 rounds all the time. You know, no one's going to question that. And anyone who's, you know, preaching Krishna consciousness, trying to get someone to chant one round, no one's going to question if you want to be a devotee, go chant 64 rounds. You know, it's just not going to happen. So it's a very good decision, you know. So, yeah. It's all on tape. The mission, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, the cause, particular branch, which was, in fact, you know, the main, you know, branch of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission at that time. And that failed, and then another branch, which is now the main branch of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission, is established as ISKCON. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think such people would be like this all the day. Those who follow properly and those who are not adopting it. They will still, because it's still not complete. As complete as Krishna consciousness. So till it would take them a few lives till they finally come up to this level, or it's like,
well,
everyone is following Krishna, but still it's not complete. So when they go back
They can go to Vaikuntha. Some of them may go to, many of them may go to the heavenly planets.
Yes.
Some, you know, I mean, amongst most religions in the world today, you know, Srila Prabhupada did point out that it's very hard to find even one true Christian. You know, they're there, but it's difficult to find, you know, to come across, you know, there's even, you know, real yogis, you know, which is practically impossible in Kali Yuga. They're there, but it's very hard to find, you know, true, sincere followers of Christianity or Muslim. But they're there. But, it, you know, they, Some may go to the heavenly planets and some may go to Vaikuntha. You know, Krishna Loka is you know, something very, very rare to attain. You know. For that, they will have to take training in Krishna consciousness, you know, under Vaishnava Guru. Yes.
So that could come only after a few lifetimes of practice?
Well, they may take birth.
And
in the next lifetime, if they take that opportunity of Vaishnava Association, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just a few drops, though, isn't it? No? Is it? Today?
Yeah?
Lord, it's come out of there.
Yeah.
Is that why they talk in tongues?
Probably. It's not that the priest
finished
off the whole lot.
The priest finished
the whole lot.
No, you say what, behind the curtain? No.
In front of everyone. In front. They just
drink
all the
chances. Did they? So they have, and then the priest is like, you know.
Yeah.
They take that.
They give it to each other and then they pour it all and
they have quite a few bowls. Some of the monasteries, they actually have the grapes and they make their wines and things like that. You know, as I say, what is actually acceptable according to Jesus and what they're following can be two different things. But, you know. Can we just get that light on? All right, so let's... Anyway, you know, it's...
Sorry,
Going to Brahmajyoti and Vaikuntha, you know, they're you know, these are quite rare things, but they're attainable if they follow. But the way they're following, you know, a lot of them like they'd end up in the body of a dog rather than.
Yeah, there was. If someone was serious, then they believe in persons. So that's that way they'll go and then they'll fall.
But yeah, it's you can understand. This is the way you understand. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Gita, it describes, you know, that for those who worship in the mode of ignorance, passion and goodness, their destinations. Now that doesn't just apply to Hindus, it applies to the Christians, to the Muslims. So if they fit those categories, that's where they're going. Whether a Hindu, Christian, whatever they're saying, you know, whatever they're doing, if they're showing those symptoms of worship in the mode of ignorance, passion or goodness, then they will go to those same destinations. That's, Krishna is not speaking Bhagavad Gita just for the Hindus. It's for all human beings. Okay? So we can understand where they're going. Not that, you know, someone says, because I'm a Christian, I'm going here or what have you like that. If you catch the malaria bug, then, you know, you can't say, oh, I'm a Christian, I have a different, you know, I'll have a different set of reactions, you know, I'll be all right. No, you catch Christian, Hindu, Muslim, you'll get the same symptoms from that because you associate with that illness. So if you associate with a mode of material nature, you will get that result, you see. The laws of nature just act like that. So we don't have to literally understand you know, everything about Christianity or the Muslim religion or the Hindu in order to understand where they're going. You just have to understand the Bhagavad Gita. So you know, for that, you know, you just use your intelligence. You just see that, okay, they're doing this. Well, it says in the Bhagavad Gita that this is actually simply the mode of ignorance. So therefore, you see, you know. Well, if they worship angels and this and that, who are perhaps, you know, and they're worshipping them for, you know, material benefits and heavenly delights and what have you, that, and they're somewhat in goodness and they're pious and sin, then they may go to heaven.
But that's not.
No.
Also, those who worship demigods, not knowing that they are not equal to Krishna.
Yeah, that it's recommended in the Vedas.
Yeah.
You can worship the demigods if you want some material benefit, and the result is that you'll get a material result. Therefore, you know, Krishna and the Vedas ultimately say it's better not to worship the demigods, or, you know, if you only want a material result, okay, worship them. But even so, you're better off to worship the Supreme Lord, because you not only get that material result, but you may also progress on the path back to eternal life. So better to worship the Supreme Lord anyway. So worshiping the demigods is allowed, but it's somewhat foolish, you know. So therefore, it's not totally rejected, but it's, you know, it's for the less intelligent. And people are advised that you're actually following something which is for people who are less intelligent. More intelligent people would worship the Supreme Lord, because ultimately he's giving the demigods cannot give a result without his sanction. And he's also so kind that, you know, he's able to take that, and he may detect a little bit of bhakti towards himself, in which case you are going to progress on the path back to eternal life as well. So
basically, what's particularly in India, what people do today is, like, from what I understand, everyone's going to hell because
there's a lot of people. Yeah.
Worshiping demigods, but it's like, you know, the pujas and rituals which people don't even know what they're doing.
They don't really know what
they're doing.
Is the soul which evolves, the transmigration works, like, you know, it's the consciousness which is you're increasing, like Prabhu was mentioning, like, you know, it's the ladder of the consciousness. How far in consciousness are you increasing that will ultimately reach to Krishna consciousness? So, like, you know, to my understanding, Prabhu, okay, you are, like, in Maharashtra, demigod, Ganesha is very popular,
yeah.
Right? So when you're preaching to them, you certainly won't say, like, you know, stop. You know. It's the evolution, because when you come into Krishna consciousness, you will see that, like, Shiva is the greatest devotee of the Lord.
So it's not necessarily an evolution unless you are actually following a superior authority. If you don't follow any authority, there's no question of evolution in anything. There's devolution.
No.
Yeah, because, you know, anything, you know, if there's no authorized process, there's no question of evolution. If someone worships Ganesh in an unauthorized way, they don't automatically advance. They can, in fact, go backwards. Just like, you know, someone may join a university. There's a set program, you know, and standards. If they come in and just do whatever they want in that university. They can't say, well, I've been to university, I'm now advanced. They may end up in jail or in a nut house. You know, they may go there and take drugs and you know, so it's not just because they've been to the university, it's not even that they've contacted and discussed with those professors that you can say that they're actually advancing. Advancement doesn't come just by approaching that superior person. You have to approach them in an authorised way. So, you know, they can worship Ganesh, Shiva, Durga and anyone, but if it's unauthorised, there's no guarantee that they will make advancement. There may be some accidental advancement, but they wouldn't even know it if they advanced, and they couldn't distinguish between advancement and going backwards, because there's no process, there's no standard. So therefore, you know, in Krishna consciousness we have parampara, which means that, you know, that's why we study standards from Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, because we can understand when we're going up and when we're going backwards, you know. And from, you know, when one follows the Shastras, you can understand, okay, this person is worshipping Kali in a way that they are making advancement. And this person is worshipping Kali in a way that they're not making advancement. But there has to be some authorised person, literally, that those worshippers are taking shelter of. You know, there has to be an authority.
I'm not the right way over here. Mm. All I'm saying is, like, consciousness, it's like, you know, consciousness has to increase. Like, it's grade one, as Bhagavad Gita tells you, like, you know, basically that's what will go with you. Your consciousness will go with you.
Yeah, okay.
And you will start from where you left off. Anything you have done in Krishna consciousness,
Krishna consciousness.
Krishna consciousness, but how did you come to Krishna consciousness to start off with?
We studied. We
like, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
Like millions of birth times we have taken, we have created enough sukriti to come into the contact of some devotee who is able to preach us Krishna consciousness. Why not everyone could get
at,
the?
At this stage, I think that's my job. So we better move on, because we've got to get through a certain amount, otherwise we'll fall behind in our schedule. So we got to verse 7. We looked at how Dhruva Maharaj, his senses become spiritually alive, and especially his speech by, you know, preaching Krishna consciousness. Verse 7. And these verses, you know, we try to draw something from our personal application. They're important instructions and realizations of Dhruva Maharaj that we can apply within our own, you know, Krishna consciousness progress. So we're very fortunate that we have these standards. It's very important that we, look. Here's a person who actually went back to Godhead. Dhruva Maharaj. He went back to Godhead. So we can look at so many people in Christianity, we can look at so many people in the Muslim religion, we can look at so many, you know, demigod worshippers, what the hell are they all doing? Okay, there's a lot of fuzzy areas there, but, you know, our process is mostly to concentrate on someone who actually did, you know, went back to Godhead, right? So, you know, let's not get too far off that track. But, you know, it was a very nice discussion, and, you know, it was a wonderful realization. It's really nice to have, Jayaprada Radha's got the, you know, she's in with all the yogis, and, you know, so we get some insights what's going on to that world there. Chris has got some interesting patients, and, Niraj is, got some very good realizations on, you know, what's going on with the, you know, various aspects of worship throughout the world. So it was a nice discussion. But we have to, have a good look at Dhruva Maharaj, because this is where we get our standards from. You know, we have to compare, this is where all the answers to our questions ultimately come from, is who did something in an authorized way and got the result? Dhruva Maharaj. So let's look at what he did. Okay. So, in verse 7, and one of the questions that is asked is, what is the difference between Maya and Svadham? Dhruva Maharaj described how the Supreme Lord is one, but he has different energies manifest in the spiritual and material worlds. He enters the material world as the super soul. He's the supreme person. So he is a person and he's the supreme person, right, who's not different from the super soul or the controller of all living entities in the material world. He gives an example how he creates many varieties, just as fire enters into wood in different shapes and burns brilliantly in different varieties. So fire is one, but it creates different varieties of shapes and manifestations. So that's a very, there is so much, the essence of our whole philosophy is there, Achinchabeda Beda Tattva, in that one verse. You know, how much you can learn from Dhruva Maharaj in one verse. There's such nice philosophy, like that. It just sums up everything that you'd want to know about, the actual nature of God. Let's see here. Now, Prabhupada says in the very end of the purport, we should mark the difference between Maya and Svadham. For devotees, the Svadham acts, whereas in the case of non-devotees, the Maya energy acts. Right, so, for the devotees, the Svadham acts, whereas in the case of non-devotees, the Maya energy acts. So, further back in the purport, Prabhupada says that the original energy inspires a devotee, and thus he engages all his bodily limbs in the service of the Lord. And the same energy as external potency engages the ordinary devotees in material activities for sense enjoyment. Here again, just a simple statement. Basically, how do you tell someone who's under the spiritual energy, whether they're a Christian, a Muslim, a Hindu, or this one or that one, and someone, someone's actually making progress, someone's engaged in all their senses in the service of the Lord, and someone's engaged in all their senses in sense gratification. There you go. Now, whether you're a Christian, a Muslim, a Hindu, or what have you, the same distinction applies. So it's actually very, it's not difficult to understand who's following and who's not. There's so much people word juggling, but, it really comes down to some simple criteria. Any comments on that?
Yes, I went to a health program last night, and they were saying, Krishna's looking after everybody, but obviously there's a Svadham helps clarify, of course.
Yeah, so it's a good question. Yeah, so here's a nice distinction. There is a distinction how he's looking after.
Yeah.
Krishna looks after everyone, his devotees. He looks after them personally by his own spiritual energy. And for those who are not properly situated in devotional service, he's looking after them indirectly under the control of the material energy. Eventually. After many, many,
So they're not personally.
Well, the distinct, you can say the government's looking after everyone.
Right.
Some are in prison and some, and they're getting their food and the basic necessities.
Yeah.
And they're also getting a few truncheons over their head. And others are getting, really well looked after. So
yeah.
To say that, the government looks after everyone, that everyone therefore is somehow nicely situated under the government. Is that's the impression that they're giving you, which is not quite, there's a little bit more to it. So, yeah, it's good you picked that up. So, and therefore, you know, you should mark this purport, because, you know, then when you, you know, you hear things like that and you say, ah, Prabhupada mentions in the purport to Canto 4, Chapter 9, Text number 7, this distinction. So then, you know, like that. So, yes, that's right.
Because it's not represented that they are equal. It's like electricity is, it's going to be used for heating or cooling. But
yes.
But still, you know, the energy might be the same.
That's what that's what Dhruva is saying, that there are varieties of manifestations, although ultimately the Lord is one and His energy is one. But how He uses that energy, you know, in a variety of ways, sometimes, you know, by keeping the devotees under His, you know, direct protection, is His internal spiritual, and how He looks after other living entities in an indirect way, is, you know, the Maya, like that. So, you know, varieties, although the energy is one. So it's incubated by the tattva. Everything is simultaneously and inconceivably, you know, one and different. One with and different from the Lord. Many, many varieties. This is, you know, this is the, it's quite a stumbling block in understanding for most people in spiritual life. You just find that, you know, you can put a huge proportion there in on the side that, oh, everything is one. They can't understand or speak about the varieties as if that's, you know, ultimately everything is one, all the varieties are illusion. And in the other camp, you know, they absorbed in the varieties of material existence and can't appreciate how everything is stemming from the one original, you know, source like that. So but both things there exist inconceivably in a harmonious way. It's just the same energy is being utilized by the Lord in different ways. And the example there, the fire, you know, it's the one, you know, element, the fire, but, you know, according to the wood or the fuel, it will burn in many, many different varieties of ways. Verse number 8. Yeah, so he is describing, now this is, here this is interesting because in verse 9, these couple of verses form part of the preaching application, which, you know, you need to sort of focus on to some degree as far as writing essays, because we're discussing how people approach the Lord. They've got material desires, and yet even Dhruva Maharaj did, and yet he was able to go back to Godhead nonetheless. So he says, people who worship you simply for sense gratification of this bag of skin are certainly influenced by your illusory energy. In spite of having you, who are like a desire tree and are the cause of liberation from birth and death, so that, you know, they've got the opportunity to worship the Lord who can fulfill any desire and give them liberation. Foolish persons such as me desire benedictions from you for sense gratification, which is available even for those who live in hellish conditions. A very nice realization. And then in verse 10, My Lord, the transcendental bliss derived from meditating upon your lotus feet, or hearing about your glories from pure devotees, because you can only really hear about the glories of the Lord from his pure devotees, because you have to be a pure devotee to understand. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, only by bhakti can one approach me, you know me as I am. So if one is not a pure bhakta, then you don't expect that they can understand Krishna and glorify him. So you have to hear about him from his pure devotees. But, you know, the bliss derived from that is so unlimited that it's far beyond the stage of Brahmananda, wherein one thinks himself merged in the impersonal Brahman as one with the Supreme. You know, what to speak of the temporary blissfulness of elevating oneself to the heavenly planets, right, which is ended by the separating sword of time. Yeah, and of course, you know, such persons fall down. So, but the town be manat. Patatam, at the end of the purport, Prabhupada makes this important point. The words patatam, vimana, are very significant. Vimana means airplane. Those who are elevated to the heavenly planets are like airplanes which drop when they run out of fuel. that's an interesting one. So they run out of their highest results, and they, so, you know, again, such, you know, wonderful words of, you know, understanding by Dhruva Maharaj, which should be very helpful for anyone who's following a religious process. So if someone is a Christian or a Muslim, you know, they may be questioning, you know, I'm worshipping Allah, you know, or Jehovah, or whatever. Am I worshipping in such a way that I will go to an eternal transcendental abode and live there eternally, or am I, you know, going to go to some heavenly abode, you know, where I will fall back like that? Am I just worshipping for some temporary result in this world? There are distinctions. These distinctions are not properly being made because, you know, generally there's an impersonalistic understanding. Since God is one, so everyone, you know, people when they start to think of God or the Absolute Truth, they start from that platform that God is one. Therefore, everything ultimately is non-different from God, or the Absolute, or, you know, the Supreme. Therefore, everything is worshipable, and all paths are correct. You know, so therefore, you get within all the various religions of the world, and even in Hinduism, what have you, you know, and within the Vedas, the followers of the Vedas, that they believe that they. There's no necessity of making a distinction. You worship in that way, you worship in that way. But actually, there is a need to make a distinction, that if you worship in one way, you get a particular result. If you worship in another way, you get a particular result. But they're not doing that. And Dhruva Maharaj is pointing this out, you know. It's a very, you know, it's a very good instruction that applies to any religious person or any, you know, properly, from any, you know, faith. That you can't just say that, you know, whichever way you worship Jesus, Muhammad, demigods, Krishna, Ram, is going to give the same effect. But actually that's what's going on. And, you know, quite often, again, you know, when, you know, we're talking a little bit about, you know, there are many gurus, you know, so-called religious teachers, what have you, you know, who people are attracted because they perform miracles. You know, whenever people presented something like that to Srila Prabhupada, you know, before Prabhupada would speak very much, he would question them, you know, that, you know, so what is your goal? You know, it wouldn't matter whether they were, you know, from the UNESCO or United Nations or, you know, some religious group or, you know, the Rosicrucians or Christianity. You know, he would ask them, you know, so what is your goal? And of course, as soon as they mentioned that, he was then able to help them to distinguish between their goal and other goals. Because people, you know, they're just following a goal and they don't even stop to think, well, oh, there's another goal. You know, like they don't do that. They just, you know, this person did something, you know, some miracle. You know, everyone else is following, you know, like this, so I'm following. And they just, for some reason or another, they're following. And then you stop to say, well, what is your goal? It's this. Or did you understand this about, oh, no, I never really, you know, I'm following for some particular reason, but the, you know, the a mature analysis of the goal never really comes into their, you know, calculations. Okay? So here we're getting this with Dhruva Maharaj. You know, he's distinguishing. In several of these verses, that's right. Yeah, here is just describing the distinction between, serving the Lord, being situated in pure devotional service. That is the goal itself, or trying to attain Brahmananda oneness, or trying to attain the heavenly planets. He's distinguishing. And his conclusion is that just being situated in devotional service is so blissful that it doesn't stop it. So we discuss that because it is related to the preaching application. You know, it's discuss the example of the Dhruva Maharaj returning back to God in spite of his performing devotional service with material motives. In verses 9 and 10, here Dhruva is, you know, even sort of condemning his own motives, isn't he, you know, in one sense. He's sort of, he's not saying what happens is that generally, you know, if you question someone's motives that, there may be a higher motive in worshipping the Lord, you know, there may be some either cheating or some materialistic, you know, sense of gratification that you're worshipping the Lord for, in most cases people will try to justify that. So Dhruva Maharaj is not doing this. What's that? First question?
No, did you read the first question that is not relevant? You said this is relevant from that.
I was referring to essay question number 5. Right? Because there are a few points, particularly verses 9 and 10, and then 29 and 31 and 32 and 35, which is important if we're preaching to people and we come across someone who's got strong motivations, so as soon as someone is not just engaging their mind and senses just for the service of the Lord, everything else is a motivation. When you say, you come across someone with a motivation, that means if they're not situated trying to develop pure devotional service like that, then they've all got motivations. Going to the Brahma Jyoti, becoming one with the Lord, attaining liberation from the cycle of birth, it's a motivation. going to the heavenly planets, it's a motivation, you know, real motivation. So that means really when you're preaching to anyone, these verses are, these realizations of Dhruva Maharaj are essential points to consider, that they should be considering, that you, we should be helping them consider in a nice way, you know.
Right,
so, yeah. So what's that?
I'm just wondering, I'm thinking to ask is it possible for the Vaikuntha planets to progress to Goloka Vrindavan?
It is possible. Mm-hmm. As mentioned in the Nectar Devotion. So we won't go too far with that, but yeah, I'll just say we want to get through some of Dhruva Maharaj's realizations as much as we can. As far as we possibly can, we should become, you know, if we first of all become as familiar as we can with what these great personalities are, their realizations are, you'll find that most answers, you know, to questions that we have will automatically be answered by those if we familiarise ourselves, you know, to some degree. It gives us such a good ability to distinguish between. So we should try to spend as much time, especially in class and after class, just first familiarise, and then, you know, many things questions that we may have, doubts that we may have, will automatically be dissipated. And the ones that that remain after that, you know, getting fixed in that, we need to discuss more, you know, solidly to make sure, you know. You see. So, in other words, there's no use going too much into a discussion if the next verse answers it anyway. Let's do the verse first, then if something's not answered, then let's discuss it. Verse number 11. And so he asked for the Lord's blessings. What does he want? Let me associate with your great devotees. And by this, I shall surely be able to cross the nascent ocean of material existence, which is filled with the waves of blazing fire-like dangers. Prabhupada mentions here, of course, we have therefore established the International Society of the Krishna Consciousness, you know, to give this association. He makes this question, he says here that anyone who is trying to be aloof from this Krishna Consciousness Society and yet engage in Krishna Consciousness is living a great hallucination, for this is not possible. Unless one is associated with devotees, his devotional service does not mature. So that's what we were saying in the beginning. You got that? We're in verse 11, in the middle of the purport. This is very, it's sort of quite a famous statement. You know, in the earlier part of our movement, people would quote this, that, you know, if someone almost, they wanted to get married and live, you know, live in a home near the temple. Oh, yeah, Prabhupada says that anyone trying to be aloof from this Krishna consciousness movement is living a grand hallucination. He mentions this in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Sometimes this has been misused, you know, in the sense that, thinking that people, you know, devotees who live a little away from the temple are somehow fit under this category, you know. Previously, it was sort of bandied around a little bit, you know, harshly like that. But it's really just, you know, saying those who don't associate, you know, nicely in with the devotees, you know, and have faith in Krishna consciousness movement. You know. But But certainly, unless one is associated with a devotee, his devotional service does not mature. It does not become distinct from material activities. Right? Which is the point we were making, you know, earlier on when we were discussing. The Krishna consciousness movement can help Christianity, the Muslim religion, anyone who follows any process, you know, Buddhist or anyone. If they don't actually have proper guidance, their activities does not become distinct from material activities.
Hmm? So I didn't understand that blank topic. Anyone who is trying to be aloof from Krishna conscious society and yet engage in Krishna consciousness, I didn't understand that topic.
Well, in that sense, when you can take it directly that someone is trying to be Krishna's devotee, and they somehow, you know, won't have anything to do with ISKCON, then, you know, there's a, they won't have anything to do with Prabhupada or his teachings, let's put it that way. They won't have anything to do with Prabhupada or his teachings, you know, that is basically the essence of Krishna consciousness. they're really, you know, how can you, you know, if someone rejects Srila Prabhupada's teachings, where are they going to get such good instruction, you know, in this day and age?
How are they, okay. That is, we are talking for people following this only. Because so long as a person is following a Samadha Sampradaya, bona fide Sampradaya,
but if someone's following a bona fide Sampradaya, you would think that they would appreciate ISKCON, the teachings of Srila Prabhupada. If someone was following the Madhvacharya...
So you mean, when you're saying aloof from this, you're meaning that you are following it, I mean, that is, you're not regarding those principles, that's what you mean. So long as the person is following some of the Sampradaya, they're following the same principles that Prabhupada said, is what you're saying.
No.
They're not aloof from the Krishna
consciousness. No, I'm saying that, for instance, you can be in, you know, another, yeah. You can be in another Sampradaya. Let's say, you know, rather than... Yeah, you would appreciate the Prabhupada's teaching. You would... If they read Srila Prabhupada's, you know, they would understand that Srila Prabhupada is a very exalted guru, and they would appreciate his teachings. Now, if they didn't, there would be something wrong with their understanding of Madhvacharya's Sampradaya, for them not to, they'd be in the category of, even if they're in the Sri Sampradaya, the Madhva Sampradaya, what have you, they wouldn't, their devotional service would not become distinct from material activities. If they reject Prabhupada's teachings, it means that they've got something bogus going on, whatever Sampradaya they're in. Alright? You know, and then, of course, there are sometimes people who come to Krishna consciousness, ISKCON itself, and leave and decide that they'll never have anything to do again with the Prabhupada's teachings and what have you. So that also fit into this category.
My mother.
All right. So... Again, you see how Dhruva Maharaj, you know, describing the essence of what gives you advancement. He associated with Narada Muni, and he understands if someone is not associating with Narada Muni or someone like him, in you know, in his you know, disciplic line, how is it possible they can, you know, make progress? He's just understood, you know, Narada Muni's assistance was crucial. Crucial and potent. You know, and therefore his understanding, it is so crucial and potent that if someone doesn't have that, you know, it's not possible for them to, you know, properly be making advancement. You know, if... you know, say someone wants to fly, you know, a rocket to the moon or something. You know, if they don't have some, you know, assistance or, you know, association with NASA or something, how will they get there? You know, there are some things which you just, they just make a pivotal, they're so powerful and important in that venture that to do without is just ridiculous, you know. So, you know, he's comparing, you know, he's making that point that, you know, association with pure devotees really is that powerful, that crucial, that without it, you've missed the whole thing, you know. And if you think you're actually doing well and you don't have that association, that's what Prabhupada is saying, you really live in some sort of great hallucination, you know. What's that? Yeah, that's right, yeah. So,
could it also be being like, you know, you're in Krishna consciousness and you might believe, like, now let's go into solitude, you just do the chanting, and that's it, like, you know, not associating with the devotees, then you might not be at that advanced stage that, you know, like, you're trying to be aloof, you know, okay, I'm doing my 16 rounds, I'm reading the book, Bhagavad Gita, but all I do is that just in solitude, I'm not going to, depending on the state, but who I'm asking, could that be, like, in the meaning that as well?
Yeah, but Prabhupada mentions here that in the purport, he says, the last part here, in the last paragraph, he says, the purport of this statement by Dhruva Maharaj is a devotional service in the association of devotees, so serving in the association, is the cause of the development of further devotional service. By devotional service only is one elevated to the planet Goloka Vrindavan, and there is only devotional service for the activities of devotional service both in this world and the spiritual world are one and the same. So devotional service does not change. But basically, to go back to the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan, one has to engage in devotional service, as stated in Bhagavad Gita. To develop devotional service, one has to associate with devotees. It's like saying, I want to go to Goloka Vrindavan, but I don't really want to, you know, have much to do with those gopis and the cowherd boys. You know, I sort of, I like, you know, doing it my own sort of, you know. You know, I like serving Krishna, but I'll just keep away from, you know what I mean? It just wouldn't work. You know, you've got to, you know, when you get to that level that you're ready to go to Goloka Vrindavan, you're going to have to associate with those eternal residents at Goloka Vrindavan to get in there. And coming back down each level, you're going to have to associate with the devotees on our level to get to the next one. That's the way it works. It's not that you don't associate and all the way, all of a sudden you've got to associate and say, okay, I'll associate. It's the same principle from the top to the bottom.
So that aloofness, like, you know, like if I got, I'm going to do my chanting now in solitude, I'm not going to miss. Mm. Obviously, that's not
where it is. Yeah, well, you know, because we have to look at that, you know, in the spiritual world, you know, every relationship is blissful. It's very attractive, you know, and very ecstatic. It's so, you know, there's a constant newness, ever new, ever fresh nature of those relationships, and they're all loving relationships, and they become sweeter and more loving, you know, with Krishna as a central feature. It's just a very natural thing to be almost, you know, attracted like a magnet to that. So for us not to be, you know, to withdraw from that, there's something wrong with our original spiritual nature is not quite awakened. That's the original spiritual nature, and that's how we should be in our relationships. And when that the more we're withdrawn, especially from association with devotees, there's something covering our original spiritual nature, you know. So as the original spiritual nature flourishes, you know, there should be ecstatic, blissful relationship with those devotees. That's a very natural, you know, progression. And then just as we advance, as we become more and more purified, we're able to associate for longer periods and more intimately with more exalted devotees. At that. And it just, you know, gradually we make our way back to the spiritual world. So it's a very natural thing.
What can lead to this is differences amongst devotees. Can lead to, say, okay, I'm not living the moment, I leave the association of certain people.
Very austere way of life is advanced, whereas just sitting and eating prasadam with the devotees is just a very, you know, a bit slack. So that mentality. So, you know, therefore, one of the things, of course, that, the study of the Srimad Bhagavatam, as we're doing here, is to help us to achieve, is one, to appreciate what we should be doing as devotees, to progress in our personal application, how to help other devotees like that, help others understand the process of bhakti. And then if we find that, for instance, there are some major restrictions in us executing something, then we have to look at, you know, where that is. So, for instance... Yes. If we're in a temple and somehow all the devotees are quarrelling with each other, and they're reading this in Prabhupada's purport, and they're saying, well, Prabhupada, you know, in Prabhupada's present, or the guru is represented, you know, this is just not practical. Then Prabhupada would understand, well, okay, then this temple is not functioning as I want it, you know, because this has to be, this is an essential principle. How can, if the devotees are all quarrelling, then there's some maya there, and you're not following my instructions. That's what, you know, Prabhupada, you're not following, therefore you're not able to execute that. So he would have to, the guru would have to adjust, well, what is happening in the temple so that they can associate nicely, and then when they do associate nicely, they follow this principle and they make advancement. So that's why the things are in the book. Because there's the standard. Because you may go to a temple, which does happen, and you may find that, gee, I just can't get along, or, you know, or people don't get along with me, you know, or what have you. And therefore, well, that just, you know, then, you know, advancement must be a different way. So we may think like that. Therefore, we study the books. We think, no, I'm thinking that way, but that's not correct. Actually, I actually have to do that. So therefore, an adjustment has to be made in the way devotees associate with each other. That's where the adjustment is, like that. See? Now, that's why we have these standards. Because I have seen sometimes in different temples that that they may not be, the devotees may not be following properly Krishna consciousness and not getting on, and people do think like that, that it's actually the only way you can make advancement is to not associate intimately or too closely. So it happens. Yeah. So that's why Prabhupada's got everything in writing. And what Prabhupada, it also gives us faith in Prabhupada. Because we might say, well, Prabhupada, you've sort of established something, but it's just not really going to work. But we can't criticize Prabhupada because Prabhupada's just doing what was accepted by Dhruva Maharaj millions of years ago. And what was established by Narada Muni and all the Acharyas. So therefore, we can't just say that Prabhupada's invented something that doesn't work. So not only is it in the book, but we have, so many different authorities substantiating the same thing. So therefore, it becomes something we definitely got to accept, no matter how difficult it is. And we've got to make that adjustment until, it works as an individual and as a, a temple community. In a temple, where they weren't studying Prabhupada's books, they would come to the wrong conclusion. If they weren't properly studying Prabhupada's books, it is Prabhupada's books which always saves us from coming to the wrong conclusion in our progress in devotional service. That's why it's so important. And this has happened, it has happened in different places. I've seen it. Devotees not so fixed up in the proper understanding and actually committed almost a little spiritual suicide, some permanently and some, temporarily, because of just not drawing the right conclusions. Then in verse 12, he's describing that, again, glorifying the effects of associating with devotees. And persons become somewhat aloof from material attractions. In verse 13, and then he's glorifying the Supreme Lord himself. Glorifying this wonderful form of the Lord who's now before him. Now all kinds of methods of theorizing have come to an end. Next verse, he describes that he understands that the Lord he is seeing before him is not different from Gavadakshaya Vishnu. Because that, you know, it's important to understand, of course, that you know, the Lord has many different forms, incarnations and expansions, and still the Lord, it is the same Lord, the same person with unlimited forms. You are the original personality of Godhead, full of six opulences, and you are eternally the master of the three modes of material nature. Thus, you're always different from the ordinary living entities. He maintains the affairs of the universe, and yet he stands aloof and are the enjoyer of the results of all sacrifices. You know, he's not maintaining the universe for, you know, to get his own personal kicks. He's aloof. And still he's the enjoyer of everything. These things are, you know, people's, you know, even when people do come to the conception, they accept that God may exist, they don't have a very high opinion of him. You know, why did God do this? Why has he allowed this? You know, why are so many people suffering? This is all God's fault, and you know, and God is playing his games, and you know, God is doing this, and you know, there are so many different things, but actually he's maintaining everyone's existence. He's aloof. In other words, we have our own, we have our independent desires, and he's maintaining us, you know, so that we can fulfill those independent desires. Actually, you know, still the whole material energy, you know, is his, you know, property, and therefore he's the ultimate enjoyer of everything. So, you know, we can take the example of a prison that, you know, we can say a government is, you know, ultimately the one who derives the results from the prison house. They're the enjoyer of the prison house. And the government sets up a prison for its own satisfaction. What is that satisfaction? You know, the criminals will be reformed, and you know, innocent people will be protected. They're maintaining the prison, and they're the enjoyer of the why that prison was set up. But at the same time, they're aloof. You know, they're not, you know, it's not that they're wanting to persecute some particular individuals for no particular reason, for some, you know, personal pleasure, what have you. You know, they're basically just neutral, that, like a judge in a court, that this one will go to prison, you've committed this crime. You know, they're not, you know, personally involved. They're just like that. So they're aloof, and at the same time they're an enjoyer, and they're maintaining it. You know, this is a nice realization of the Supreme Lord. So Dhruva Maharaj is offering these prayers. so we see, you know, people from any religious person could actually just derive so much understanding, because they're all, they can't. You know, so many times when I, for instance, if there's a great disaster and you watch the news, they'll always ask the local priest, what they think it is. And most commonly, they say, I can't understand. I can't give any answers, you know. It's very rare that, you know, that you hear a statement that makes sense, you know, they can't make sense of it. You know? And people are depending upon them. Well, you know, why is this happening? You know? They can't give an answer. But all the answers are here. You know? For everything. For everything that's happening in this material world, that people can't understand, that they have a, you know, that they blame God or think he has these bad qualities or what have you. The proper conception is here. And very easily answered, as we said, you can just give a very simple analogy in the same way that a government maintains a prison, this material world is maintained. And that is a complete description here that Dhruva Maharaj has given, that they're the enjoyer, but they're aloof, and they're maintaining, you know. That is a you know, a wonderful analysis of you know, the prime qualities that someone in any religious person, if they have some understanding of God, they should understand those three qualities, and that will answer all the questions about what happens in the material world. But they don't understand any of those at all, and you know. As Prabhupada points out, you know, he will quite often ask many religious people, you know, tell me something about God. And they'll say, God is great, or God is love. And that's about it. He said, well, you know, anyone can say that. You know, like you can say, well, so-and-so is wealthy. I want to know how wealthy. How much money has he got? How much property has he got? You know, tell me something. Oh, he's wealthy, that's all I know. Well, is he wealthy in that man? Well, don't know. You know. So, but a devotee, you know, they actually have realization of the nature of God, that they should be able to unlimitedly glorify him in so many different ways.
But we can't glorify God, I mean, God is a strategy. Like you, Mother, example, tells us that though he did so much of austerities, he could not glorify the Lord and just.
God touched him with the conscience, then he could glorify God.
So, where would we be able to do it? And
this Krishna gives us everything. Well, I've seen you pass some exams and write some essays. You're doing okay. But you obviously, you know, that's a fact. So, but according to our, you know, as we progress in devotional service, our realization of the Supreme Lord becomes more and more substantial. At the stage of Bhava Bhakti, Bhava Bhakti is, you know, there's that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Puriyogam Tam. I think I quoted that last week. Tadami Puriyogam Tam. In essence, you know, that's fully realized at the stage of Bhava Bhakti, that one has, you know, there's proper assimilation. Buddha Bhava Samanvita. Buddha Bhava Samanvita. Buddha Bhava, Buddha, that understanding, you know, at Bhava, you know, there should be some, you know, substantial, you know, transcendental ecstasy and stage of transcendentally situated. Someone serving the Lord, completely aloof from the material energy. Basically, sex life is, you know, there's no sex desire, and you know, one is not attracted to the material energy and is very, very attracted to the Supreme Lord, engaging in pure devotional service without offences and what have you. At that stage, one assimilates so much. We may, you know, hear and you know, read the Srimad Bhagavatam, but the stage of assimilation happens, you know, at that stage, properly, fully. You know, one has a proper mature understanding. So, you know, for each level of devotional service, we are trying to come to the platform of assimilation. And then, you know, Advaita Bhakti actually one fully assimilates it, because as far as a living entity can, you know, the glories of the Lord and devotional service. So he describes the difference between the Lord and, you know, simply his impersonal manifestation in the verse 16. And that Jnana Misra Bhaktas. Jnana Misra Bhaktas. Devotees whose devotional service is mixed with empiric knowledge says that that, you know, the impersonal feature or Brahman manifestation of the Supreme Lord is meant for persons who are essentially very advanced but still not able to understand the personal features of variegatedness of the spiritual world. Such devotees are known as Jnana Misra Bhaktas, or devotees whose devotional service is mixed with empiric knowledge. It means that they're basically jnanis and they've got a tinge of bhakti. We're not saying that they're basically bhaktas who have a tinge of jnana. That's not what it's saying there. Yeah, because it's Jnana Misra Bhakti. So they're a Jnana Misra Bhakta. So we're not calling them Bhaktas, we're saying they're a Jnana Misra Bhakta. Essentially, they're garnish. A little tinge. Now here it says that that he is the supreme personified form of all benediction. Asisha. Asi. Therefore, you know, one who engages in your devotional service with no other desire, worshipping your lotus feet is better than becoming king and lording it over a kingdom. That is the benediction of worshipping your lotus feet. To ignorant devotees like me, you are the causelessly merciful maintainer. Just like a cow who takes care of the newly born calf by supplying milk and giving it protection from attack. So the Lord is literally the personified form of all benedictions. Everything you could possibly ask for to be benedicted with resides within the form of the Lord. you know, this is Dhruva Maharaj knew that he had come to worship the Lord in devotional service with a motive to get the kingdom of his father. Such an adulterated devotee can never see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. He therefore felt very grateful for the causeless mercy of the Lord. The Lord is so merciful that not only does he fulfill the desires of a devotee who is driven by ignorance and desires for material benefit, but he also gives such devotee all protection, just as a cow gives milk to a newly born calf. A devotee must be very sincere in his devotional service, then although there may be many things wrong on the devotee's part, Krishna will guide him and gradually elevate him to the highest position of devotional service. The demigods don't do that. If you worship the demigods, you know, they're not going to protect you from the foolishness by, you know, for which you may have approached them, you know. And so, you know, this is why Krishna is also saying it's very unintelligent to worship the demigods. You know, when Krishna is prepared to, he sees that they're you know, very foolish and very vulnerable. He says, better you worship me. I can fulfill those material desires, but not in such a way that you'll come to the harm that you may come to by worshipping the demigods. It may just give you something and say, run along.
When it says things wrong on the devotee's part, yes, does this include accidental?
No, it means that they're not sincere. Well, for instance, here, Dhruva Maharaj was driven by ignorance and desires for material benefits, so that's something wrong. Right? So, you know, if we have, you know, if we're in so much ignorance about, you know, so many things, so that's a problem, you know. We don't really know, you know, what we're doing sometimes, or you know, what we should be doing, or what our goal should be, and you know, as a result, we want things that not only that, but we want things which are not good for us, and we want things which are just really have nothing to do with serving the Lord. You know, they're just really selfish things for our own sense gratification. But here, you know. You know, the Lord, this is quite interesting because here the Lord has actually appeared before Dhruva, even though really, in essence, he may have been unqualified. You know. We understand that Prahlad was protected by Lord Nrisingadev, he's a pure devotee. But Lord Nrisingadev will also protect even the neophyte devotees. One doesn't have to be, you know, on the platform of Prahlad if they're sincere. And nor should we discount the fact that, you know, you know, sometimes devotees who, you know, they're not sannyasis, they're not gurus, they're not in some big position, they're not big devotees by any measure, in one sense, may have some quite substantial association with Krishna and his associates at, you know, just different stages. You know, sometimes just, you know, like here, Dhruva Maharaj saw the Lord. sometimes the Lord may, you know, that's, I think they're called spariti, where the Lord may appear to a devotee just, you know, momentarily, just with some vision. Uh, generally there are different stages of devotional service which these things happen, you know, from bhava, bhakti, what have you. But it's not out of the question that devotees can have some, you know, actual association with Krishna, Radharani, you know, just, you know, some rare occasions where, you know, the Lord is actually detecting just such sincerity in a person who's maybe unqualified in many other respects, that the Lord just really wants to, you know, guarantee this person's success because, you know, the sincerity is there, even though the immaturity, you know, is also there. So we shouldn't. You can imagine that many insincere people can also read the same, you know, purport and verse and you know, then run around.
We have some very nice stories.
Who's that?
We have, I think in our sampradaya we have some nice story that Madhvacharya's son, when he offered the bhoga to the Lord, he did sincerity. His father asked him once to offer. I don't know, I'm saying his name, the father had, he was doing normal deity worship. The son was very small. And he said, today I can't do, so you please do it. And mommy prepared, but you offer the bhoga. The father went off. The son offered the bhoga. And he was sitting there and he said, God, why aren't you taking? Normally when my father offers his cake, what have I done wrong? Please take it. And my father was calling me and he starts crying. That sincere offering, God actually comes and takes it.
Yes.
So much so that the father, when he comes back, he can't believe it. And he says, so there's a prasad, God has taken. He can't believe it. And he said, okay, you offer tomorrow, I'll see. And same thing happens. And so he went, his father comes, the Lord goes off. He got it now.
That's right. There's a nice story also. There's one lady in ISKCON who was she was the wife of a temple president in one of the centres, but she you know, just a very, you know, not a very prominent person, you know, as far as like just, you know, just serve her husband nicely and small temple, but she also had some very she left her body, but she had some association with Krishna, she, you know, and his associates, and she was telling the devotees, you know, what Krishna was doing and saying, what have you, you know. So, but but that, you know, if the sincerity is there. So you sort of... I do get people come up to me, devotees who come up to me and tell me that they've seen Krishna and things like that, but, you know, I sometimes question their sincerity. I think both have got to be there, you know. I think there's got to be some sort of significant sincerity. It was happened the other week. I was a couple of weeks ago. I was up in the Prasadam Hall setting up. Some new devotee came up to me. He's only been here a couple of weeks, and he said, "I don't know who I should talk to, but maybe I think you're the right person." You know, I've just seen Krishna and he's told me I'm completely pure now. And,
they came to be descendants of the Yadu dynasty and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu dynasty.
He asked me what I should do. He said, Some people may say I'm hallucinating, but you know, what do you think? I said, I think you're hallucinating. I said, he'd been around for a couple of weeks. And I said, he was a little bit angry, and I, but he kept trying to convince me, and I said, I think, you know, maybe you should go home and have a good sleep and sleep, see if you feel better in the morning, you know. So. He hasn't, he still comes, but he hasn't spoken to me much since then. But. So, you know, it's, we, you know, don't be surprised if even young devotees, you know, have some story to tell, but you really do want to see some sort of sincerity. And, you know, sincerity also would mean that if someone is, you know, here, Dhruva Maharaj, he got blessed by the, you know, the Lord, you know, awoke him from whatever ignorance, and that was there. So therefore he understood, you know, I've got a lot of impurities, you know, that Jaisi, you know, I was wanting so many material things. So he had a good realization about, you know, his very motivated and immature way of devotional service. You know, Dhruva Maharaj didn't, you know, wasn't saying, well, you know, now I've associated with you, I realize how great I am, you know, such a big devotee like that, you know. So the proper realization of one's, you know, position, and here Dhruva Maharaj is sort of saying that, you know, like, as a result of the mercy of the Lord, you know, I can realize, you know, your mercy and my utter dependence, you know, that I'm sort of being attacked, as he says here, you know, giving it protection from attack. Dhruva's, you know, I'm sort of being attacked by Maya even while I'm trying to serve you, and you've protected me like that, you know. So you'd expect that within their realizations, if they're sincere, they have a proper understanding of their own, oh, you know, I'm a very, you know, young devotee, and somehow I've got some, not that I've realized the Lord and he's confirmed that actually, you know, I'm pretty much there and always have been, you know, like that. So, you know, there are ways to tell that, that something is not bona fide, but at the same time we shouldn't be surprised that sometimes, you know, Krishna does associate and his associates in some ways with, you know, even young devotees, you know, who are, you know, sincere in their Krishna consciousness. That's an interesting point there. All right. Let's leave it there. The great sage Maitreya continues, so we hear what Maitreya says, that you know, the Lord gradually congratulated him, and so we'll be up to verse 19. You know, mostly, especially look at those verses 29 to 31, 32 to 35. They're in relation, you know, we had quite a discussion today on worshipping the Lord with material motivations, you know, in all sorts of different religious faiths and what have you. Religion is one, but, you know, people think that they're doing something different. And you know, these verses continue that same theme of Dhruva Maharaj. In spite of performing devotional service with material motivations, you know, he returned back to Godhead. So it really does have a lot of application to associating with each other as devotees. You know, some still, you know, on different levels, some, you know, having strong motivations and what have you, and also associating with people that we're preaching to, coming to the movement, who may have different, you know, there's some wonderful things to understand there. So we'll try and finish that chapter next time we meet. Yeah, it's been a long time. Yeah, is there something happening? What? Okay. So is that a low? Is that a? You're saying there shouldn't be, or who goes to the retreat? You'll go to the retreat. You go to the retreat. All right, so, you think we shouldn't have the class next week?